Today is Friday, May 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, state of emergency as riots expand in the U.S. city of Minneapolis over the death of a black man in police custody.
We're not letting this corner go to all of the anarchists that are here that want to destroy our community. We are not letting this corner go to anybody. This is our streets. We're going to fight for our streets, and we're going to fight for justice for George.
An attorney in France fighting for justice in the case of the accused mastermind of the Rwandan genocide. Also ahead, the latest on the global coronavirus pandemic. It's all on today's International Edition. Violent protests have rocked the U.S. city of Minneapolis following the death of a black man in police custody. Joining us is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice in Minneapolis, who lives just blocks away from where it happened. Jack, thank you for being with us. What are you seeing and have been seeing?
Since Monday, when Mr. Floyd was killed in the streets of Minneapolis, the protests have expanded, the looting has expanded, the officers in the streets have been firing tear gas, we've been seeing rubber bullets, and everybody is fighting about who is going to charge this officer or if they're going to charge this officer. I walked out my front door this morning, and there was charred remains on the sidewalk, in the street, in my yard, and burning buildings. There were 10 buildings burned last night because of the protests, because of the looting, because of the tear gas, because of the rubber bullets in Minneapolis. And that has only expanded. On Thursday, what we're seeing is even more. This has expanded into the neighboring counties. We now have the mayor of Minneapolis, who's called a state of emergency. We have the National Guard, who has been called in. There are hundreds of people in the streets in various cities around the area. And so there is a lot going on, and there's a lot of people very much on edge.
All they want is an arrest, and they'll stop. So as a criminal defense attorney, why has this officer not yet been arrested?
The reason he's not arrested is because he's a cop. I've had plenty of clients who have been arrested on less. What should have happened was on Monday night when this happened, this officer should have been arrested. Mr. Floyd was dead before he reached the hospital, and this man should have been arrested. Normally what you would see is a charging prosecutor filed a complaint on Tuesday, would have appeared in front of a judge on Wednesday, and they would have set bail, I guess, between $500,000 and $1 million. At this point, that officer is free. Nobody has charged him.
My understanding is there's potentially been other accusations against this particular officer in the past.
There have been multiple accusations against this officer and his use of force. And I think this really reflects the general problem. This is not the first time that an unarmed black man has been shot down in the streets or killed in the streets of Minneapolis. So the people of this city are used to this, if you could call it that. They know what this means. And the problem is you can watch this essentially live. You can go on social media and watch the entire thing happening as the light drains out of the eyes of this man for everybody to watch as this officer has his knee on his neck. Not just 30 seconds, not just a minute, but for minute after minute after minute. Is this murder? Yes. Yes, it is. There has to be a social contract between the people and the government, between the people and the police, and to know that the police are there to represent and help everybody. The African-American community in particular feels that they are not just second-class citizens, but maybe worse. They're the enemy because this has happened so many times. It's so fundamentally unfair in the first place. But secondly, apparently, it doesn't matter if you do it. And if you do it live and everybody can see it happen, even then, it's not enough to charge. That's what they're saying in the streets here. And at this point, there's something to be said for it because that officer is still free.
Minneapolis criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thank you for that update. Meanwhile, on Thursday, U.S. Attorney Erica McDonald in the District of Minnesota pleaded with protesters not to resort to violence.
Peaceful protests are always acceptable. That is the cornerstone of our justice system, is that people have the right to say how they feel and to talk about their feelings and to protest peacefully. But the obstruction and the destruction of property and harm to individuals has got to stop.
McDonald said she understands the emotions are running high.
It breaks my heart to see what is going on in our streets in Minneapolis and in St. Paul and in some of our suburbs. And I am pleading with individuals to remain calm and to let us conduct this investigation.
Charles McMillan witnessed the death and describes what he saw.
Three or four officers were standing there with him, had him down on the ground, and then one officer come up and put his knee on his neck. And as he had his knee on his neck, he kept saying, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe."
And we are also now learning that protests are expanding to other cities outside of Minnesota, including Los Angeles, California, Memphis, Tennessee, and Denver, Colorado. About 159,000 more people in 24 European countries have died since March, early March, than would have ordinarily been expected, according to the World Health Organization. Katie Smallwood, a WHO emergency official, said its timing recorded as thousands of people were dying in intensive care units in places like Northern Italy, France, Spain, and Britain points to COVID-19's deadly impact. She said Thursday, countries beginning to reopen need to be extremely cautious.
So opening businesses or clubs, bars, where people do come together will absolutely have to depend on a very strong ability of the health system to know how the virus is transmitting, where it is transmitting, and then most importantly, especially if people are allowed and the decision is taken to allow people to come together in closed settings, that as soon as transmission occurs, that the health systems and the disease control systems can very specifically and in a targeted manner understand where the case is, understand who the contacts are, and ensure that targeted interventions to prevent and break any transmission of the virus can be put in place.
So far, more than 2 million people in Europe have been sickened by the new coronavirus. That's up from 15% over the past 2 weeks, with Russia, Turkey, Belarus, and Britain leading the way in new infections. African nations are having diverse experiences with the coronavirus pandemic. South Africa is the continent's hotspot. Uganda is beginning to ease restrictions after no reported deaths. And the tropical island of Mauritius appears to have gotten the virus under control. Health ministers from those nations met recently to discuss the unique challenges the pandemic poses and why preparation is the one thing that matters regardless of where you live. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The coronavirus, medical experts like to say, doesn't care about borders or language or any of the cultural aspects of humanity. Like viruses the world over, it just sees targets. But since the virus appeared on the African continent some 3 months ago, it has taken a different course in different countries. The continent recently reported 100,000 positive cases, but they're spread unevenly. South Africa leads the continent with more than 25,000 cases and rapid growth, whereas the small tropical island of Mauritius hasn't seen a new case of local transmission in more than a month. Meanwhile, countries such as Rwanda and Uganda that have previously sparred with epidemics have reported cases in the hundreds, but no deaths. Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's regional director for Africa, says the organization is training more than 10,000 health workers in an attempt to decentralize their response to deal with these different realities.
Most countries still have fewer than 1,000 reported cases. This means that as governments ease lockdowns and other social measures, it's important that the strong public health measures are in place all over the territories, not just in the capital cities, that communities are empowered and enabled to take preventive actions, and that we continue working on strengthening health systems and delivering essential services to people.
In Mauritius, the nation's Minister of Health and Wellness, Dr. Kailash Kumar Singh Jagutpal, said preparation was key to the nation's response and its apparent success in containing the virus.
Mauritius registered the first cases of COVID-19 in March. Our monitoring and preparedness action plan was in place already since mid of January. The Mauritian Prime Minister himself chairs a high-level committee on a daily basis. This allows the government to have daily updates on the evolution of the pandemic and implementation measures.
Despite seeing rapidly growing clusters of the outbreak, South Africa recently announced a new approach. Houses of worship will now be allowed to reopen, with limited congregation sizes and precautions. That, Health Minister Dr. Zwelium Kise explained, is part of the strategy. Deputize trusted institutions like churches to teach South Africans how to live with the virus in the long term.
It has become clear that we are likely to have this pandemic for more than a year, maybe even to 2 years. And therefore, it is important for us to understand that there is a degree of easing. And in this process is to begin to motivate for every part of our society to focus on social and behavioral change.
And in the East African nation of Uganda, which has yet to report any deaths amid its fewer than 300 cases, Health Minister Dr. Jane Acheng said the health system was already well fortified by other lethal epidemics.
Uganda has had opportunity to have several outbreaks. From the year 2000 to date, at least we have had over 6 Ebola outbreaks and about 5 Marburg outbreaks and several other outbreaks. And these outbreaks have given us opportunity to build capacity, but also to build systems in place which can easily be activated to respond to epidemics as they are occurring.
Moeti, who said that cases in Africa remain lower than in other parts of the world, said one thing holds true across this continent. The virus doesn't let its guard down in its quest to survive. And so she said, we shouldn't either. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
More than 400 Malawians who returned from South Africa have escaped from a coronavirus screening camp in the economic capital, Blantyre. Test results released Wednesday night were positive for 46 of the escapees, while nearly 300 had yet to be tested. The situation raises fears the virus could quickly spread in Malawi, which has so far confirmed 101 infections and 4 deaths. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
Social media videos showed tens of Malawians jumping over fences at Blantyre Skamuzu Stadium Wednesday morning while police watched. The stadium was being used as a coronavirus screening camp for Malawian migrant workers returning from South Africa, the African country worst hit by the virus. Malawian police said the returnees complained of a lack of toilets and bathrooms in the stadium, then began forcing their way out on Tuesday. Police service spokesperson James Kadadzera spoke by messaging application from the capital, Lilongwe.
We were told that most of the returnees wanted to go home due to a lack of necessary social amenities. Some were actually seen forcing their way out. And as the police, we did our part to making sure that we contained the situation.
Test results released Wednesday night showed that 46 of those who escaped tested positive for the virus. Another 300 escapees had yet to be tested, raising fears the virus could spread further in Malawi, a country with one of the weakest healthcare systems in Africa. Health officials are trying to downplay those concerns. Gift Kawalazira is the head of preventive health services at Blantyre District Health Office. Speaking at a press conference broadcast live Wednesday, he said authorities would easily trace the escapees as they have their contact details.
We must admit it was a system failure, but people can take solace in the fact that whatever was happening on an open air. The stadium is an open air, so the chances of actually you contracting the disease are quite minimal as compared to if you're sitting in a bus or if you're in an enclosed space.
Kawalazira says authorities have since beefed up security at other screening camps to prevent further escapes of those being screened of the virus. But questions are being raised about how seriously authorities are taking the pandemic after reports that some of those being held bribed police into letting them leave. Police spokesman Kadadzera says they are investigating.
We got wind of the same. So our officers are on the ground investigating, but let me assure you that we as a police service, it's our duty to making sure that we are taking a role in protecting further spread of this deadly disease.
Meanwhile, authorities announced Thursday that nearly 600 more Malawians are expected to return home from South Africa over the weekend. 200 of them are expected to arrive by military helicopters in the capital, Lilongwe, while the others will arrive by bus. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
In the U.S., where the number of COVID-19 deaths has surpassed 100,000, the toll that lockdowns have taken on the economy continues to look grim. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports that the U.S. economy shrank in the first 3 months of the year, even faster than originally thought.
Economists are expecting far worse in the current April to June quarter, but the Commerce Department has updated its first quarter growth estimates, and they show the gross domestic product fell at an annual rate of 5%. The original estimate was 4.8%. The downward revision reflects weaker investment by businesses in their inventories, which was partially offset by slightly stronger consumer spending. It's the biggest quarterly decline in more than a decade, when the economy shrank 8.4% in the fourth quarter of 2008 during the depths of the financial crisis. Ben Thomas, Washington.
China has approved a new national security law for Hong Kong that critics say threatens the city's semi-autonomous status. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo reported to Congress, Hong Kong, quote, does not continue to warrant treatment under U.S. law, a move that could mean suspending its preferential trade status. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
China's legislature voted 2,878-1 in approving a resolution to impose new national security laws on Hong Kong. China says the aim is to end sedition and subversion. But critics say the law is designed to crush the peaceful protests that have challenged China's Xi Jinping.
We want to say no to the security law because the law destroys Hong Kong. We don't have any freedom and any freedom of speech, nothing.
The U.S. stands with the people of Hong Kong, says State Department spokesman Morgan Ortegas to VOA.
Broken promise from the Chinese Communist Party to the world. And you may have seen just recently we had a joint statement, United States, Australia, Canada, and others that are calling this for exactly what this is. This is an assault on freedom-loving people around the world.
U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi also condemned China's leaders.
It's a brazen move on the part of the Chinese government. It's a brazen move, and Hong Kong is so much part of the vitality of trade and commerce that goes into mainland China. You would think that they would want that vitality to continue, but President Xi is a very oppressive tyrant.
Many around the world fear the new law, if imposed, will give China an excuse to prosecute all kinds of normal actions.
For example, criticisms of the Chinese government, criticism of the Communist Party, would then be considered seditious and people could go to prison. So that really makes a mockery out of the rule of law, out of autonomy.
The U.S. is one of Hong Kong's leading trading partners and one of the largest sources of direct investment. With Washington's declaration that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous, the resulting loss of preferential trade status, say experts, could have a devastating impact on the vibrant financial hub and its people, who are used to enjoying basic freedoms and a high standard of living. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. U.S. President Donald Trump and French President Emmanuel Macron agreed in a phone call on Thursday that the G7 meeting should be held in person and in the near future. Trump, in March, canceled the Group of Seven leaders' meeting scheduled for June 10th in the U.S. as the coronavirus outbreak was spreading around the world and international travel was curtailed. The U.S. Justice Department has accused North Korea's state-owned bank of evading U.S. sanctions laws and charged 28 North Korean and 5 Chinese citizens in its largest crackdown on North Korea sanctions violations. In a grand jury indictment made public on Thursday, U.S. prosecutors accused North Korea's Foreign Trade Bank of conspiring with the employees charged to cause other banks to process at least $2.5 billion in illegal payments. Skirmishes between Taliban fighters and Afghan security forces recommenced in Afghanistan in the day since a 3-day ceasefire expired, but government officials Thursday said that the incidents were minor and the truth can still hold. The Taliban have remained silent on government appeals for an extension of the ceasefire, which was announced for the holiday that ends the Muslim holy fasting month of Ramadan. Stay with VOA for all the latest world news. The arrest of Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga is stirring emotion and determination for a conviction from Rwandan citizens living in France. Joining us now from Paris is Richard Gisagara, the attorney and advocate with the Rwandan Community Association in France. The group brings Rwandans and friends of Rwandans living in France together to support each other and create community. Thank you so much for being with us. Now that Mr. Kabuga has been apprehended after all of these years, I am sure in some ways it has brought some comfort and relief, but given the amount of time that he was unable to be located, while it may provide relief, he did not do it alone. What is your group now focused on as far as justice for all of these victims? What do you want to see happen?
First of all, what I would like to say is that the Rwandese Community Association, for us, the fact that Kabuga was arrested, we consider that like a big event, mainly for two reasons. The first reason is it shows us that despite the fact that the genocide happened 26 years ago, the victims of the genocide, the justice have not forgotten the genocide survivors. So he still think about them, thinking about bringing them justice despite the long time which has passed. We consider it like a big event because that's really very important for the genocide survivors to know that the international justice did not forget them. And second, it's a big message which is sent to the perpetrators of genocide, wherever they are and whatever powerful they are, because Kabuga was someone really very powerful, and what age they have. This is a strong message telling them that wherever they are, one day they will be touched by justice. What we want now is that Kabuga be judged. We know that legally speaking, what will happen will probably will be judged by the International Tribunal, by the residual mechanism, of which is in Den Haag and in Arusha. The first wish of the victims of the genocide would be that Kabuga be judged close to the people where he perpetrated the genocide. The first option, if it was the wish, would be that he be judged in Rwanda. But now we are aware that that is not likely to happen. So what the victim of justice wants is justice. So whether it's rendered in Den Haag, in Arusha, or in Kigali. Now, what we want is him to be judged, even though he's judged far from them. The most important is that he be accountable before the justice of what he have done.
What about the family members, associates on multiple continents that may have aided in his eluding capture for all of these years?
This community in France wants these people also to be persecuted and be judged for helping him for so many years and prohibiting the victims for getting justice. These people live in France. The fact of prohibiting someone for being prosecuted, hiding him, when you know perfectly that the justice want to arrest him, it's an infringement to law. So that's why the community of Rwandese people living in France have lodged a lawsuit before the prosecutor of Nanterre. That's the place where Kabuga was arrested. They want all the people who are implicated in helping Kabuga escaping to justice be prosecuted and judged. So we can't let these people do what they have done without responding to justice of their facts.
Are you planning to fight to get these other people, some of which have been his family, have been in the courtroom with him in the last few hearings?
That's what we are planning to do. That's really something important for us. It has to be done. It has to send us a message to all other people who are helping other people who are wanted until now. So they have to know that this behavior should not remain unpunished. So that is something important that we are planning to do. For the moment, our main objective is to have Kabuga be prosecuted, but that fact also very important, and we will do our best so that these people also be prosecuted. So you are telling me about the one who are in court with him. Of course, you understand that in tribunal is their father who are being judged. We are not surprised that they come to help him. We are aware also that French law doesn't allow the prosecution of people who helped their parents to escape the justice. That's how French law is. But we can't believe that Kabuga have only been helped by the close family. So we believe that you have also other people who are far from the family, who are not close family, who helped him. So those ones, since the law doesn't protect them, those ones, we want them to be prosecuted, and we will do all our best so that this be the case. But for the moment, our main objective is getting Kabuga be judged.
You and others in the courtroom, seeing him in person, what sorts of feelings did they bring out in you and others in your group?
Mitigated feelings. First, you are happy to see him be judged, because everyone who knows about genocide knows how Kabuga is a big fish. Everyone knows he's on the top list of people searched by the prosecution. So everyone in Rwanda knows the name of Kabuga. So in the courtroom, when you see him coming, the first feeling you have is the feeling of satisfaction. But on the second, you also feel some kind of regret that this happens only after 26 years of the genocide. For sure, a regret. You have so many people who would have liked to see Kabuga being judged, but who are now unfortunately passed away, or maybe who are too old to understand exactly what is happening. That's why you have a mitigated feeling, satisfaction, and the regret that this happens too late.
That was attorney Richard Gisagara with the Rwandan Community Association in France. The U.S.-Canadian border has been closed since March 21st. Families and friends on either side of the border have had to be satisfied with online meetings or phone conversations. But now, some of those separated by the coronavirus pandemic have found a way to meet at a special park that straddles the border between Washington State and British Columbia. VOA's David Byrd reports.
Peace Arch Park is a shared territory between British Columbia on the Canadian side and Washington State on the U.S. side of the border. Admission to the park allows visitors to explore both sides without going through customs. Now, it has become a place where those separated by the coronavirus pandemic can reunite. Blaine, Washington resident Lois England and Surrey, British Columbia resident Ian Hendon have been dating for 3 years. But she has no affiliation in Canada, and he doesn't in the United States. So when the border was closed, they were separated by the coronavirus pandemic. Earlier this month, the couple met at Peace Arch Park following the longest separation of their relationship.
When it first closed in March, we hadn't seen each other until just last weekend. Finally, they opened the park. Not so much the border, it's still closed, but the park is open. And I grew up in Bellingham, and I never realized that this was considered no man's land, that Americans and Canadians could meet here.
British Columbia's NDP health critic said in a recent interview that the reunions raise some concerns because couples do not technically have to self-isolate since the lines for the border are staggered. Earlier this month, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced the border closure would continue until June 21st and could be extended. A recent survey by the Angus Reid Institute found that most respondents said they would prefer the border remain closed longer than June 21st. 42% of respondents said they preferred sometime in September. Another 26% said they want to wait until the end of the year. I'm David Byrd, VOA News. I
didn't ask for a free ride. And this week, Lady Gaga and Ariana Grande are showing how to weather the storm. They've teamed up to release a joint video to promote their new single, Rain on Me, from Gaga's upcoming album, set for release today. In the video, the two artists deliver a playful weather report, The Chromatica Girls. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Please take care and be well.